back with episode 509 of The Critical Myth. I'm John, your host, and tonight we have...
Edmund from Greenville, and I feel a strange stirring in the web, like an old enemy has come back to life.
This is Gary from Jacksonville, and I never thought that comics would aid me this much in popular culture, but it's sure coming in handy lately.
And what's that? The brothers Winchester are still having problems? You betcha. Okay, and we are going to be going along with, we are in the middle of the week, and we are going to be doing more genre news, then we're going to jump into our break, and then we are going to be recounting our thoughts on the lowest performers this past week. And then, we'll see where it all evolves from there, because that's when things open up a bit after that. But first, before we do any of that stuff, Edmund, if you could please.
Absolutely. Our policy around here is to discuss anything and everything that might have happened in the news, on TV, not so much in our personal lives. You don't have to worry about that stuff, but you will be horribly spoiled on all of these shows. So that's why we always try and wait a week before we do that to you.
No, I'm definitely going to spoil you on what happened on Wednesday morning in the office. Definitely. No. All right. Well, we are going to jump right into some genre news here. And Gary, you didn't get a chance to really do any of the news. So why don't you go ahead and do the first one here?
Sure, we're talking about Sherlock star Andrew Scott to play the new Spectre villain in the next James Bond movie that's coming out. And I'm sort of interested. I'm glad that they're digging into, I guess, younger talent. Sometimes, a villain that's too old won't appeal to some audiences. So I guess this really sort of gives me a sort of a sense of where they're going with the franchise that they are trying to grab younger audiences.
Yeah, I did drag myself out of bed at 6 a.m. to watch the announcement live from Pinewood, and which the Gary just gave away the biggest part, but the new film is going to be called Spectre, and the behind the scenes on that, I had actually not realized that the whole Kevin McCrory Thunderball authorship dispute and all the legal wrangling over the rights had actually included Spectre as well. So it was actually the settlement last year that allowed them to actually use Spectre again. So it was nice to see them immediately taking advantage of that. And but what was also funny about the announcement was we'd already had this rumor the previous day about Andrew Scott coming on and playing a villain, but when he was announced, Sam Mendes did say he was Denby, and he is an MI6 operative. But then when Andrew Scott actually came out, all the rest of the main recurring cast, Ralph Fiennes as M and Ben Whishaw as Q and Miss Moneypenny, Naomi Watts, we're all grouped on one side of Mendes, and then Andrew Scott came out and remained on the other side of Mendes, along with the other definite villains, which included Dave Bautista from Guardians of the Galaxy, who is going to be playing Mr. Hinks, and I suspect, given Mr. Bautista's imposing nature, could be I'm hoping a new recurring villain a la Jaws for the 21st century, and but also they aren't going completely younger, because Christoph Waltz was also announced, and Mendes didn't mention his character name, which had me immediately wondering, so he is going to be, it is Waltz as Blofeld, and they just don't want to say, but then it turned out that was just Sam Mendes. He's just not checking his notes, but his character name is apparently Oberhausen, so or Oberhauser. Aww. So yeah, and that was announced on the official 007 Twitter feed. So. Not rumor.
So there's no cat casting news. Is that what you're trying to tell me?
Not yet. No.
No, Adam Scott is going to be the cat. No. You see, this is just like Benedict Arnold, or whatever his name was supposed to be John Harrison in the second Star Trek remake.
Oh,
right?
Oh, right.
So clearly, Christopher Waltz is going to be, what was his name again? Clearly, that's not at all a red herring.
Exactly.
In any way, shape, or form.
Exactly.
Right?
That's the other speculation now, of course, is who is actually going to be revealed as Blofeld by the end of the movie. And some people are actually saying it could even be Monica Bellucci, who was announced as one.
That would be an interesting thing.
Yes. So.
You know what? That is the perfect. They could be doing this in a very canny way, because think about it. Wouldn't that be almost the perfect tagline for the film? To have at least two or three different choices as to who is actually the Blofeld character.
Yes.
And have that be, who is Blofeld?
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like, have that be the thing, because, you're supposedly this may be you know, if it was a true reboot with Casino Royale, who could it be? You know, who is this supposed to be? Who is this guy? What's going on here? Kind of thing. So they could really play with that a lot.
Definitely.
And have a lot of fun with it. But we'll see how that goes. Edmund, if you don't mind taking the next one, since it was a little bit of a surprise to you to begin with.
Yes, absolutely. Legends has actually been renewed for a second season. It seemed a little bit, I thought it was a little bit late in coming, or at least making it public. But sort of cliffhanger. I mean, I would give them credit for the fact that they did kind of wrap up the major mystery, but it certainly was opening up a whole new can of worms now that we know who Sean Bean actually supposedly is. I mean, this is still a Howard Gordon production, so you know, it's I wouldn't say it's everything set in stone, but it's certainly set on an interesting path for that second season. So you know, and definitely a case of they left themselves lots of room to basically relaunch it for season two. So I am interested to see what they come up with.
Oh, absolutely. I know, Gary, you weren't watching this show, if I recall correctly, but this was one of those real surprises of that summer season. Just the fact that it turned out to be such a watchable show, when at first I thought, oh, I'll give it a shot because this is a... this is a Howard Gordon show, after all, and it'll probably just tick me off before the end, but it actually wound up holding together fairly well, especially towards the end there.
Yes.
Let's see. This next piece of news is more casting news, of course. It's not really news.
Well, it's official news now.
Yes.
Yes. Benny Cucumber has been confirmed to star in Marvel's Doctor Strange. And everybody knew that was coming. So I think that it's just nice to finally have it just put and set in stone. Of course, there are still the people that are a little bit upset that it was not a person of color per se. There is still this ongoing confusion that I've seen repeated that they are in some way whitewashing the character, even though,
Doctor Strange.
Yeah, exactly. But whatever the case may be. But again, this may be why everyone is worried that Cumberbund is not going to be able to continue on a very rapid pace in working on Sherlock, although he continues to say, as we talked about last show, that he is going to do everything possible to stick with that. Any surprises or thoughts on this, gentlemen, or is it pretty much a given at this point?
Well, I'd say it is pretty much a given that they were even saying that essentially it is finally confirming it. Yeah, I guess that at this point, we can just wait to see where it fits into his schedule. Although this one does supposedly have a firm release date of November 4th of 2016. So yes, he does have plenty of time to fit it in.
Yes.
Well, you know, with all due respect, I mean, how many episodes is Sherlock really? You know, it's not like they're shooting that thing for, you know, like 6 months. I mean, yeah, with an average season of what, 4 to 6 episodes, I'm not that concerned that they'll be able to fit in his Sherlock filming at some point. So that's not a concern. But I'm glad, unlike some announcements I hear of him being cast in various roles, this one I feel he's really going to pull off well. So I'm quite looking forward to it. I think this is one of the better fits casting-wise for him. So I'm happy to see it.
Yes, we'll have to hope that he actually rocks the goatee. Anyhow, also in some casting news, this one I'm thinking is maybe a little more... I don't know if the word would be kind of contentious or controversial, but it is unexpected. Kristen Ritter has been cast in the role of Jessica Jones on the Marvel TV series that will be airing on Netflix. Kristen Ritter as Jessica Jones. I'm not sure that that's who I would have thought of.
Oh, I wouldn't have thought of her.
Yeah.
A matter of fact, as you were mentioning the for some, although I find it odd to mention it, whitewashing of Doctor Strange, this would seem to be a character that would be much more open to... alternate casting isn't quite the right word, but you know, more diverse casting could easily be done with Jessica Jones, and I really feel like they chose not to.
I feel like they kind of, how do I say this? It feels like they cast much younger than I ever would have expected them to. I'm not sure that the actress is necessarily young, but she looks so much younger than I think I ever would imagine Jessica Jones being, because Jessica Jones is supposed to be somebody who was a superhero and then has retired for a certain period of time. So, yeah, it's just a little odd. She doesn't strike me as having the gravitas needed for the kind of material that I'm expecting from...
The actress is about, I think, 33 or so. So she actually is.
Yeah,
but that's the thing. She doesn't look at it all. So she's going to have to play very... You know, she's going to have to kind of work at it a little bit.
Yeah, because, you know, the character for, you know, and honestly, the Jessica Jones character, even for me as a comic book person, sort of snuck up. You know, she was never really highly mentioned until she showed up in a rather recent run of the Avengers over the last few years. And but, you know, she's supposed to be, I guess, I really want to use the term disillusioned with superherodom, but still needs to, you know, have a job to earn money. So she tries to find her little niche. And yeah, it lends itself towards someone that's, I agree with you, older and a bit more weary of the world, so to speak. And yeah, this actress doesn't seem to come across that way.
Well, before she got kind of heavily used as a support character for the Avengers in the comics, she was in Marvel was trying to have their own version of Vertigo, basically, as an imprint goes. They had their Max thing, I think, and she was in a series called Alias. And what I recall is that, boy, did that go in some places that I think you need an actress that can really pull off some tough, dramatic material. And that's just where I don't see how this fits. But we've been surprised before, so...
Yeah, well, the Max imprint was geared to be very much an adult comic book line. And in some ways, I think it was a lot harsher than the DC's equivalent of Vertigo, where Vertigo sort of, you know, went in a lot of different directions. Max was intentionally a lot more violent, physically, where people would literally, you know, get, you know, beat to death and things of that nature, much more so than Vertigo, if you want to, you know, consider the Sandman series or or other things in that like. So it was a much more brutal, gritty type of comic book line to run, and definitely her character fell into this. And as I say, dark, gritty, violent, you look at this actress, as you said, and it just doesn't seem to click.
Yeah. I know someone who was really looking forward to this particular show, and I'll be very interested in her reaction of this casting, because I am almost certain that this is not what she had in mind. But at any rate, well, that's it for the genre news for this show this time around. We're going to go ahead then and go into our break, and when we come back, we're going to discuss the bottom three shows of the week. This could get brutal. We'll be right back. right. So I think I mentioned earlier on that, you know, this was an odd week because even though we had a show that came in below average, there was only one show that did. All the other shows were above average and in most cases an 8 or higher. And so when I talk about the bottom three here, the number three show for the week came in at an average score of 7.7, which we would normally think is pretty darn good. And in this case, it's kind of pulled down a little bit by what I feel is almost an unusually low score. So this is a case where when we look at an average across all the people that are reviewing it in the Critical Myth team, sometimes this is why we want to take everybody's opinion into account, because we want to see where we have this wide range of opinions. And in this case, we're going to talk a little bit about Sleepy Hollow.
If we do nothing, we all die.
Our world is merging with purgatory. All bets are off.
I will lay down my soul to stop this apocalypse.
Are you willing to lay down your sons?
Do you know how many people have gotten burned claiming the end is nigh?
It's hailing blood. You know what you have to do.
Enough deceit! If the end is upon us, are we too late?
Okay, and Edmund, why don't you go ahead and do the recap for this one?
Certainly. This is Sleepy Hollow, Season 2, Episode 11, The Akida. Sacrifices are made, and loyalties are put to the test in the fight of good versus evil. And
mm-hmm. It's very succinct.
Yeah, and could only be applied to just a few thousand offerings over the last few decades. But anyway...
Yes, but how many of them have Ichabod Crane going goo-goo over a motorcycle?
Yes, indeed.
Not many.
Yeah.
So you gave this one a pretty high score as well.
Yeah, I was going to say, one thing that's odd in this case, I was actually flipping between a 7.5 and an 8 and landed on the 8, so I almost dragged it down slightly further.
Oh, well, I'll just say what I liked about it, because yeah. I mean, those who are interested in seeing Henry's opinions, they're best represented over on the review on VogNetwork.com, so I would definitely go over there and take a look at that. For me, the reason that I liked it is that they took everything they've been doing in this first half of the season, and it felt like it all came together. And it all came together in a way that brought some plot items that I didn't think they would touch at all for a while and brought them into focus way earlier. The fight against Moloch went in a way I didn't expect it to, but mm-hmm. when you look back, it actually makes a lot of sense. This would be an episode that provides a perfect example of writers knowing when a character has gone as about as far as one can go and needs to be shuffled off the stage and done. They do it in a spectacular fashion. So I didn't really have a whole lot of problems with this. If anything, it felt like the lead up into this mid-season finale was a bit weaker than it needed to be. But I would not have thought that this was at the bottom three for this week. If anything, it's like I said, it's when there's so many episodes this past week that wound up being as highly ranked as they were, something's got to be in the bottom three. And I guess this is the one that drew the short stick this time.
Yeah, I guess for me, I mean, where I was a little less complimentary to it was, even though as it played out, I could see where they'd been playing up the issues of family and the fact that he is still their son, and obviously that did become the driving force for his final turnabout. To a certain extent, I think it was because of some of for me, the whole first half of the season, I did not understand why they felt the need to introduce the Holly in particular, especially when they were building up to really emphasizing the familial ties and that being what turns things around. Because for me, it really wound up being that it was like when they got there, it almost felt a little perfunctory to me, and that they could have actually done more to build up that conflict and the influences playing back and forth on Henry. And it was a case of I saw what they were doing and I saw what they were building up to, and once they actually got there, I was like, no, guys, but I think you could have done it a little bit better. Not that it was done badly, but it could have been done better.
Yeah, fair enough. I think that at the end of the day, part of Henry's thing is Henry's development.
Yes.
Just that, like you said, it did a really good job of playing up why he went into Moloch's camp, but maybe didn't establish the relationship between him and Katrina as well as they could have to set up why he would do what he did. But I would say that that might actually be the one thing that was holding back some of these previous episodes, is that I think the writers understood Katrina as a concept more than as a character.
Yeah.
As soon as they had to write her as a character instead of as a plot device, things got messy. And they never really have gotten good at including her in the mix. I think there was one episode that they actually did a really good job with, and that's about it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and also, I mean, it seemed odd the way they introduced that whole element of her being sort of spellbound by Moloch and seeing him as a kid, and then which had some interesting implications. And but then by the next episode, she's already trying to assassinate him. It was partially because of the extreme growth spurts, but that was sort of my first inklings of, you know, yeah, there's stuff that could be going on here that you're shying away from, and kind of going for the more shocking and twisty, which admittedly is what they, you know, what really drove the show in the first season, the way they were willing to just take the crazy elements of the show and just really push them. And I think in especially with them wanting to lead Henry to that turnaround, they were missing chances to kind of emphasize those background elements in ways that would have made that even more effective.
Hmm. Yeah, you know, at the end of the day, Sleepy Hollow, I think the reason that it has been and had been so successful in the first season and much of the second was that it tapped into a lot of that kind of anything goes accelerated plotting that The Vampire Diaries was carrying on so well for a while there, and it allowed people to overlook its flaws. And then it got to a point where it's not able to do that quite as well anymore. And I'm wondering if Sleepy Hollow, in trying to get serious too quickly, this season, kind of lost a little bit of the synergy that they had of just, you know what, just go with the goofy fun of it. Don't overthink it. And I think maybe they overthought it a little bit. That said, I really like the way that they ended it up. If nothing else, the ramifications of what happened should be fun to play through.
Yes.
And that alone is, to me, a good enough place for it to stop as a mid-season finale.
Yeah, definitely. And the other thing I really hope is, once it happened, and Henry dispatches Moloch, it was really, really bringing home to me. I mean, also just having John Noble in the episode for longer periods of time. One of the issues of the first half of the season was that, you know, yes, John Noble is now on board and actually, you know, a regular cast member, part of the opening credits, but he was spending so much time just being trying to be the puppet master behind the scenes, we were really losing a lot of those interactions, and just giving John Noble the chance to actually be really part of the main cast and interacting with everybody together, which is what I hope is going to start happening now that when they come back, I think we'll really improve things. And not that it's going to go back to the way he was in the first season, but I think it'll work much better if they're back together as a unit.
Mm-hmm. I would agree. All right. Well, then the next one on our list, the second lowest scored episode of the week. This one, probably not a surprise to many people. If most of the shows were above average, the shows that tend to fall in the average range almost like clockwork are going to probably wind up towards the bottom. And that's certainly true here again with our friend Elementary. Here's the promo.
Holmes and Watson always think on their feet.
You think someone's riffed his hand off? There are weightlifters who are more than up to the task.
But next Thursday,
I challenge you to a test of strength.
It's brains versus brawn.
3, 2, 1.
You win.
New Elementary, CBS next Thursday.
All right, and Gary, if you don't mind doing this one.
Absolutely. We're talking about Elementary, Season 3, Episode 5, Ripoff. Holmes and Kitty investigate the murder of a postal store owner whose death is connected to the illegal diamond trade. Meanwhile, Gregson's career is placed in jeopardy when he hits a fellow New York police officer.
All right, and as we said, this one came in at an average score of 7.3. So, not bad. I mean, it's an average score, so, but yeah, you guys kind of came in at an average score between the two of you, obviously. So, Gary, what? I mean, it's just kind of a standard episode, I guess?
Well, I want to pick Edmund's brain for a second here, okay. Just to get a touch of our sort of reviewing. Do you like the fact that Watson is so minimized at this point?
No, of course not.
Okay, and I think that accounts for some of our scoring. I mean, this wasn't a bad episode, but and as nice as Kitty is, no, I want Watson back. You know, that's why I watched the show. And the noticeable gap in absence of her, even though she's technically there, is glaring for us. Sherlock has become a much less interesting character to me without Watson to play off of. He seems to be somewhat regressing, being much more into himself and not as outgoing as he typically had been. And I like that aspect of the character, and we are not seeing it.
Yeah, I mean, because the whole idea that they introduced at the beginning of the season of Watson coming into her own during Sherlock's MI6 imposed absence was an interesting idea. But now I guess the intent is but we need to get Kitty introduced, and so we're going to shuffle Watson off to Denmark and just have her not actually appear on camera. Although then in this episode you have the whole subplot of Holmes finding her casebook of Sherlock Holmes that she started writing back in the first season, and getting all bent out of shape about that. So it's like, you literally have her literary ghost hanging around the episode. So, you know, yes, it was helping establish Kitty to a certain extent, but then doing it through partially through the reactions to Watson's manuscript, and so it wound up just reminding us of, you know, oh yes, there's this other person who's far, far more interesting now, who's not here at the moment.
So is it just a matter of one of those shows that kind of messed with the formula that was actually keeping it from falling apart?
Well, I wouldn't say it's that much of a train wreck, John. No. It still had a decent score, and the heart of the story, you know, the issue with Gregson, and they don't go into it in the mini review, but you know, where he's defending his daughter, basically, it was a good plot. It was a good story, good B plot, and even the plot with the diamond smuggler was reasonably well thought out, and for Sherlock, I'd say it was a strong plot line. But yeah, the formula, it's not tasting as well a show as it used to taste. It's not that it's bad, but we just know it can be better.
Yeah, I'm thinking in terms of of course on CBS there's Person of Interest, which manages to take the procedural template that it sort of snuck into the network with, and then of course just keeps tweaking it and playing with it. And then there are other shows, and what really popped into my mind that with the way that things are happening this season is a show like House, where yes, they changed up the team, they brought in different people, but throughout that, you know, one of the things that I still watched it, but I didn't enjoy it as much because it just became all about replicating that same formula again and again and again. I fear that Sherlock is possibly falling into that same trap of, yes, we'll let Watson have the character development, but we still need that sidekick around. And what they were doing in this one with using the Gregson situation to bring out some of Kitty's past and her advising him on how to basically give his daughter some space and let her make her decisions rather than trying to jump in was reasonably well done, but it also felt somewhat formulaic as well. So especially for a Sherlock Holmes based show, it would be nice to see them taking more of the Person of Interest route and trying to get away from the formula rather than coming up with a whole new version of it.
Okay. Anything more to say about that one, guys? Or are you pretty well surrounded on this?
I think we got it pretty well surrounded. What do you think, Gary?
I think we hit on what we like and what we don't like and hint and change back. yeah.
Okay. Fair enough. All right, then. The Let's go ahead and move on to what is, unfortunately, the lowest scored episode of the week. And I kind of already alluded to this, but I'll go ahead and just state it plainly here. It was Supernatural.
Yes.
Yes, I know. Here's the promo.
Next Tuesday, when the boys hit a roadblock.
I got nothing.
They bring in the big guns.
Saw this a big one? Hope you drive a Porsche.
You ever think there are things out there?
Monsters.
Monsters.
Shut the front door.
Supernatural, all new next Tuesday, 9, 8 Central on the CW.
All right, Nedmund, if you don't mind doing the recap, please.
Certainly. This is Supernatural, Season 10, Episode 8, Hibbing 911. Jody Mills reluctantly attends a mandatory sheriff's retreat and is partnered with an overeager sheriff who wants to bond. Even worse, a body with just strings of meat and skin hanging off the bones is discovered. Jody calls Sam and Dean for, well, advice, actually, not help, but of course they come running anyway.
Exactly. Okay, so this one came in at a not terrible, but not exactly awe-inspiring 6.8.
Yeah.
So... yeah, so 6.8, which is just a tick below average. I guess we should be happy that it came in there instead of where the previous episodes were coming in, which was not particularly good.
Yes, and I will mention we are missing a bronze thumb score, so it always has the potential to go up or further down. So.
Yeah, I feel like this one it could have gone either way. Yes. Although I think it's more of a does it stay where it is or does it go down?
Yes,
type of situation. But there we are. Edmund, just your thoughts as a neophyte to the show. I mean, it's almost not so much anymore. Five seasons in now, so but still.
Still just the second half. I still have not made it back to season one. I keep intending to, but for me, this whole doing a takeoff on Fargo routine just fell completely flat to me. And after this string of going from, you know, yes, you know, we had fan fiction, but that was, you know, the special 200th episode. But then going into Clue and going into Girls, 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 which seemed horribly disjointed. And then this one where, I was excited to have Jody Mills back, but then to have it in, and pairing her with Donna, where it's one of those cases where, you better have watched the previously on, because otherwise I would not have remembered her from the fat eating episode, spa episode. And it just felt whole horribly forced to me. And it was about three quarters of the way through that it was sort of popping into my head of like, oh, wait a minute, no, is this another of those potential character pairing they're introducing in the hopes of it might take off for a spinoff? Once I realized that, just my main thought was, why would you do that to yourselves, guys, when we've got a perfectly good remake of Fargo airing on a different network that was basically blowing this out of the water? And I'm sure that was part of my issue with it was, we've already seen Fargo redone, and this didn't hold a candle to that remake.
Well, the other thought that comes to mind is, was this supposed to be some kind of parody or something? Because if it was, it didn't work.
No.
I think that Donna was the kind of character that never, ever should have been brought back.
Mm-hmm.
The Fargo-esque jokes were fine the first time around. And I say fine with a grain of salt. There was just no reason to bring her back, and not insult to injury of having Jody come back in this kind of role when she was kind of on a nice trajectory to become, if Garth wasn't going to do it, then for her to become almost like the new Bobby.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I don't know. This was just really ill-advised in my mind. That said, it's more... to me, the problem is not that it was just a really terrible episode so much as that it wasn't anything special.
Mm-hmm.
And after three episodes now since fan fiction, which really showed that the writers and everyone involved were perfectly capable of pulling off a really solid episode, we haven't seen one in 3 weeks.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's kind of disturbing in that regard, but what are you going to do? Yeah, that's what else is there to really say about this one, do you think? Anything more?
Not particularly. Other than, and I guess it's more, this is just an indication of, you know, where no, I mean, the instincts can still be good, but that whole sequence where, you know, oh, look, lo and behold, everybody's gotten knocked out and tied up, and it's almost like everybody, all of them deliberately coming up with ways of just extending the scene and trying to needle the villains, because, you know, somebody's going to get themselves untied. And they just need to make sure they leave themselves enough time to do it.
No, that never happens.
Yeah.
That's no. That was fresh, man. Yeah. Completely fresh. All right. So yes, unfortunately, Supernatural comes in at the bottom. But to be fair, the nice thing about it is that the bottom is really not that bad, all things being considered. It could have been that bestiality episode from a couple seasons ago.
Yeah.
That would have been bridged too far. But anyhow. Let's see then. All right, so those are our bottom three for the week, and I see we still have a bit of time left over for this particular episode. So here's where we kind of change things up a little bit more. Gary, there are other shows on this list other than the top three and the bottom three that we haven't really gotten into, and I'm just curious, out of any of these, which one would you pick to discuss?
Well, I want to talk. Well, the one that that hit it out of the park for me was this week would probably have been The Flash.
Okay.
I really liked the episode a lot. If we could talk about that for a minute or so.
Sure, no problem. All right, let's go ahead then and run the promo.
What's that for?
We're here to train.
What? Like Rocky?
You shot me?
I heard you heal fast.
We'll help you catch a bad guy. The one who robbed the bank.
Metahuman.
I'm not calling him that.
Partners?
The Arrow made another appearance last night.
The Arrow gets results.
He's a crazy man.
Where is he?
He said he doesn't know.
No!
Once and for all, who would win? Me or you?
His arms are like twice the size of yours.
Harry has superpowers. Oliver has a bow and arrow.
Please tell me you're not actually having this conversation.
You missed.
No.
Flash versus Arrow. The epic two-night event begins this Tuesday at 8, 7 Central on the CW.
All right, and Gary, why don't you go ahead and do the recap then?
Absolutely. We're talking about The Flash, Season 1, Episode 8, Flash versus Arrow. This crossover event starts with Barry teaming with Oliver Queen to stop a metahuman who uses his abilities to control people's emotions while he's robbing banks. Meanwhile, Eddie tries to put together a task force to stop The Flash, and Caitlin and Cisco deal with a new team in Star Labs. I really like this. As I've gone on about the series before, I like the comic book sensibility that this show has, as well as its somewhat optimism. So bringing in a character like Arrow, who we talked about last episode, you know, much darker, grittier, willing to take chances and, you know, kill people in the past to get the results that he needs. It's quite the comparison, but at the same time, we have to remember that, you know, as they said in this episode, you know, Arrow's been doing this for, I think they said, was it 8 years at this point?
Well, 8 years between the island and Star City, so yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, so, and, the, you know, so versus this rather new team as far as The Flash is concerned. And so, you know, there's, you know, some realities as well as some optimism that, you know, that to play off both Oliver and Barry's teams. And, you know, I like to feel like they got the mix right. They, you know, they presented Oliver presented some of the facts to Barry's, like, you have all this time, like, you should be, you know, checking out the area before you get involved and things of that nature. Common sense things, but something that a new person might not think to do. I still quite can't understand shooting Barry with two arrows in the back, but it seemed a little bit much. What if he hit a lung or something? I don't know, but one have been sufficient. But to make his point, but you know, but that just shows, I think, the level of violence that Arrow is accustomed to dealing with, which, you know, Barry isn't. So I thought it was an interesting thing to do, to bring Oliver sort of into Barry's world and have him scale things back a little bit and show that some of his methods just aren't needed, or aren't, you know, there's other ways to go about resolving him. I particularly liked the way the Star Team sort of, you know, just obliterated any sort of hint or illusion of who Arrow was. I'm blanking out on his name, but you know how the Doctor basically says, "Yeah, well, you need to call Oliver Queen to Felicity because you know we're not playing this game anymore." And I sort of like the openness that was forced upon the whole situation. I thought that was good, and it fit well. The only part that didn't quite work for me was this whole Eddie starting this task force against the Flash. The Flash has seemed to be a rather positive force when he's been involved, so I can't understand that the city would mobilize against him like that. So that was the only thing that sort of struck me as a little odd.
Fair enough. Okay. Edmund, what did you add to any of that?
Yeah, well, actually, I was going to say for me, the way they use the metahuman power and it taking over Barry and bringing out that angrier side, because certainly all the things he has been through, and there's definitely a case to be made for a lot of long bottled up anger and resentment being there and ready to tap. And I did like the way they used that to rather quickly get away from the whole skeevy hanging out with Iris as the Flash behind Eddie's back stuff that had been going on, turning him at least in the during that one public outburst into a character who doesn't seem quite as quite as good as he was appearing up until then, however much that might be mistaken, and the result of other forces, but that midway, I mean, is a very comic booky way of parsing things out as well. So I think it's still in keeping with that less real, shall we say, the slightly less realistic focus compared to Arrow, and it seems like the writing team perhaps weren't really quite sure of how to handle the Iris situation, and I think where they brought it to now feels like the best place for it. So I was very happy with them for resolving that throughout this episode.
Now, Gary, I'm not as familiar with, say, The Flash or anything like that, but for me, the whole thing with the influence on Barry having come from Red evoked both Red Kryptonite, and actually, considering what kind of anger and resentment was coming out, it almost seemed like they were touching a bit on the color spectrum for the whole Lantern side of things for DC.
Yeah, well, that's a nice thing, although having Red as anger or hatred, I wouldn't necessarily say we have to go up as far as the more recent emotional spectrum things of Green Lantern. Having Red as a symbol of anger or something goes back a long, long way before that. But yeah, the character Roy G. Biv, if you follow out the letters, you know, is actually the spectrum, red, the orange, and so on, and that actually has been an established character in the Flash Rogues Gallery. I want to say it's Rainbow Raider or something along those lines, if I remember correctly. And so it has been an established character, and it's a nice way to bring in an established character. I thought it worked reasonably well, and it gave us the classical comic book trope of our two heroes having a reason to fight each other. And it was sort of fun to see them play off each other. You would automatically honestly think that Oliver would be hopelessly outclassed, but at the same time, he was able to keep up, which was fun, and it's a challenge for the writers to make that sort of thing happen. So
I was just curious but if that's actually an established villain, maybe, or character,
yes.
then yeah, I guess that makes sense. All right, well then, if we have nothing more to say about The Flash other than the fact that really, when you get right down to it, again, this and the second part that took place in Arrow as far as a crossover really came out equally good as far as the average opinion was concerned. So that's a nice touch there. It's good for both shows. Edmund, based on what's left on the list, What's your wild card pick, Ice?
Let's see. Why don't we talk about, since we touched on Sleepy Hollow and its shock ending, why don't we talk about The Walking Dead?
All right, and here's the promo.
Microsoft Surface presents scenes from the next episode of The Walking Dead.
I'm Rick Grimes. You have two of my people, Beth and Carol. I'm here to make a proposal.
You won't live.
You have to do whatever it takes. This is who you are until the end.
For more video, go to AMC.com.
All right, and if you could do the recap, please.
Certainly. The Walking Dead, Season 5, Episode 8, Coda. Rick seeks a peaceful agreement when rules and morals are tossed aside by new enemies.
Uh-huh. And, this particular episode is a really good example of just where this first half of this season has been, because it came in at an 8.2 average. And that being said, I'm just going to very quickly go over to the master list over here and see where that falls. And 8.2 is actually the best episode score since the second episode of the season. So out of 8 episodes, it's definitely one of the higher-ranked episodes. So that maybe gives an impression as how this first half of the season really hasn't been up to the usual par. And, yeah. I'm just curious, Edwin, what did you think of this mid-season ending?
I think what it brought out for me, and even though I gave it an 8, which is a good score, but I think it could have been much higher if they had done a better job at establishing the hospital and the characters in it. The way they were just jumping around and basically just introducing that entire subplot in that one episode that focused on Beth and the aftermath of her kidnapping. Especially given what the way they were then trying to negotiate between the different factions, and it just really would have had much more impact if you'd really gotten more of a chance to know those characters. And it feels to me like since Woodbury, with the Woodbury aftermath and the community that the governor basically walks into and manages to take over, certainly even with Terminus, they're having a harder time establishing these alternate communities for them to interact with, and it feels like they're kind of trying to find their way now that they're having them split up into different groups more, and it feels like they haven't quite figured out how to keep the narrative thread going so that you can come to a big mid-season, fall finale, whatever they're calling it now, and have it have more impact than it did, because to a certain extent, at the end, there was a sense of we're losing Beth just because we feel like we have to lose someone. it really wound up feeling kind of random to me.
Oh, I would say that the problem was actually the opposite. There were two characters that felt like they were spending the last several episodes building up as a potential departure. And that was Beth and Carol. And if you were to take either one of those and think to yourself, okay, which of those two is the one that is likely to be done with character arc? It's Beth.
Mm-hmm.
And it just felt like this, basically, what it is that this show has gotten to the point where you, as soon as they start putting a lot of focus on a character, that's almost like a red flag. And I think people were expecting Beth to go late last season when they had the big episode with her and Daryl, because it's like, okay, Beth gets a big character episode with Daryl. I don't think Daryl's going anywhere, so who do you think is going to be the one to go? And she wound up getting kidnapped. Quite frankly, since she got kidnapped, has she really gotten – she's got a lot of screen time? Has it amounted to much of anything? I don't think it has. Other than the fact that I would say that of all the people in Rick's group, which one was the most likely to be able to integrate into another community because of an optimistic and positive attitude? Beth.
Yeah.
Who wound up being just as paranoid and distrustful as anybody else? Beth. So what it tells me is that when Rick or any of the other ones come up to any other society, especially after this, they're going to be just really distrustful and unwilling to bend and not let down their guard. And it's kind of backing into some storylines. And that's where I feel like it's like, yeah, this whole diversion to Atlanta just does not feel like it worked out very well in the long run. It's dragging that. You get the sense that even within the story, they feel like they've lost direction and they need to find it. So, Gary, what are your thoughts on The Walking Dead midseason finale?
Well, death of characters is a staple of this show, so in some ways it didn't catch me off guard. But at the same time, I was hoping they'd come to maybe not an alliance, but some sort of better ending with this other group of survivors that, you know, society, without getting too crazy about it, that society would be starting to rebuild to some extent, where you'd have these pockets of survivors that, while brutal at the same time as they have to be in this new world, are still starting to respect each other again, and you at least have some sort of alliances to some extent. And I was sad to see that it all crumbled apart at the end. I mean, it made sense. I wouldn't say it came out of nowhere, but it was just I was dissatisfied with the ending, just from, you know, just from it could have been ended much more positive than it did.
Hmm. Yeah, there's a feeling of inevitability just because there had to be inevitability to somebody dying, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, I'd love to see pockets of people that are fighting back and starting to be reasonably civilized. You know, as we run into pockets of other humans, most of them are pretty reprehensible. We've yet to see anybody who is reasonably moral, or, you know, or at least is making some type of effort. And I had felt that this group in Grady Hospital was trying to do the best they can, much like our group does. You know, I'm not saying our Grix group is our angels either, but it feels like they try to do the right thing, and it felt like this other group was reasonably trying to do the right thing. And so I wish there was more of that as opposed to Terminus.
Yeah. No, fair enough. And hopefully that's kind of the direction that they're going. And I feel like that may be where they're going, but also that they spent all this time trying to drive home this idea that if they were to run into people that were even more civilized than even the people in Grady were trying to be, is Rick and his group going to be able to trust that? I don't think that they will.
Not at this point.
No, because they trusted Eugene. That got them nowhere. They kind of trusted Father Gabriel. That shelter's gone. They were willing to trust Terminus. That really didn't work out. So now what? I mean, really, it just comes to a point, either they're going to isolate themselves completely to their own doom, or they've got to find some kind of new way, a new twist to do this, because otherwise they're just going to keep running into groups of people that are worse than our guys are, and over again, rinse, lather, repeat, right? But at any rate, I think we have a little bit of time left here. Where are we at, Edmund? Still got some time?
A couple of minutes, yes.
Okay. I'm going to do my my wild card here, and I'm going to pick Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. So here's the promo.
We found the city. We need to locate that temple.
ABC, 2 weeks from tonight.
Only the worthy are allowed inside.
An epic search.
We need to stay ahead of Hydra.
For the ultimate weapon.
Something really bad is about to happen.
But the team could face.
Sir, she looked exactly like Agent May.
Something even deadlier.
We can help you.
I don't need your help.
New Marvel's Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. Tuesday, December 2nd at 9, 8 central on...
All right, and that's Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., Season 2, Episode 9, Ye Who Enter Here. The team beat Hydra in the race to locate the ancient city, but a sacrifice must be made in order to expose the city's secrets. Meanwhile, May and Skye hurry to reach Reyna before Whitehall finds her. Mm-hmm. All right, and this one turned out to have a fairly good average of 8.4. I mean, that may, in fact, be the highest. I'm just going to check real quick. It is not the highest for this season, but it's well in line with the much higher seasonal average that this second season has been getting. So I'm curious, what did you guys think about this one? Certainly, I love where they're going with all this stuff.
Gary,
or anyone?
Yeah, no, I liked both the way there was a certain sense of sort of them still setting things up, but they still managed to have enough twists and turns sort of to give you some sense of not finality, but of completion anyway, while at the same time leaving us hanging off of a couple of cliffs. And I guess in my mind, I mean, the main thing, it was sort of the contrast between what's going on in the bus and Ward's villainous return, and then taking not just Reyna but Sky as well, all the intriguing implications that brings, the idea of Sky in the company of Reyna, who is extremely persuasive, as we've already seen, what that might portend, and then at the same time them attempting to get into Adelan, if we are, even though they haven't officially named it yet, and that of course going just slightly awry, leaving us wondering if Mac is alive or just completely transformed at the bottom of that entry shaft. I thought it did a very good job about both bringing us to a certain ending of things, at the same time leaving us with plenty to anticipate.
Gary, what would you add to that?
I like a lot of this episode, particularly a lot of the character beats. I like the Fitz and Simmons interchange. I thought that was that's still developing really well with this sort of, you know, their uncomfortableness around each other, and I like how it's being fleshed out slowly. I enjoy watching Coulson in the field. He's As we haven't quite seen him out as much lately, I found I've missed that. And, you know, having him go up beyond the street and some of the little quips he does, as well as just the way he carries himself, it's a very enjoyable character to watch on the screen. I still can't understand quite Reyna. I feel like I'm missing segments. You know, at one point she's allied with them, and the next second she can't wait to hop on a plane with the villains. It seems so inconsistently written that I'm a little confused as to where her alliances are. And in some ways, I don't really care. So if it's a matter of, you know, which way is she going to go, like they're doing with Ward? Ward's character, I feel they're doing a reasonable job. Hers, not so much. So it's a little frustrating. I enjoyed the way that they set up this, you know, the city underneath somewhere in Puerto Rico. And as a side note, I like the challenging, oh no, we figured out the Bermuda Triangle years ago. But we never heard any more about that. But it was a nice little throw in there. But as you said, they're revealing enough of the small picture without still giving us the big picture, which I'm fine with. So it's a nice balance. As I said, Rain is a little inconsistent for me. But other than that, Ward's I'm on your side, even though I'm helping the villain, is still working for me.
Yeah, it's just I'm like I said, I'm really enjoying the show this season, and just in the interest of time, if those who want to see my opinions on it, which echo a lot of the same things, you can go over to the VOGNetwork.com website and see my review up there. Yeah. All right, I think we're going to go wrap it up then for this particular show, and when we come back next time to wrap up the week, we're going to go through the rest of the episodes that didn't make the top or the bottom, or our wild card picks, and then we're going to probably get into a roundtable for the first time in it seems like forever.
And so ends another epic episode of The Critical Myth. If you want to leave a comment for this show, head over to vognetwork.com. Not only can you find links to the podcast version of each show, but there is a dedicated forum, a ton of written reviews, and related articles by the crew throughout the site. For the written reviews, you can even leave your own review, so let us know if you agree or not. You can also leave comments on our Facebook page, Critical Myth, on Twitter at Critical Myth, or Google+, under The Critical Myth Show. Any and all use of copyrighted material is only intended for discussion, commentary, parody, or educational purposes, in accordance with U.S. Code Title 17, also known as fair use. In other words, Please don't sue us. And of course, the statements and opinions of the Critical Myth crew are not necessarily those of the VOG network, its partners, or affiliates. But let's face it, we're probably right anyway. Until next time, watch, read, and listen, and believe in the Critical Myth.